This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoen. The medical care that Amanda Bennett's husband received cost $618,616, and most of it was spent in the last 2 years of his seven-year battle with a rare kidney cancer. He died in December 2007. Bennett's new book, The Cost of Hope, is about meeting Terrence Brian Foley in China and their 20-year marriage. It's also about how they dealt with his cancer diagnosis and treatments and their quest for a cure. After his death, Amanda Bennett interviewed her husband's doctors, tried to make sense of the thousands of pages of medical bills, which made no sense. Bennett and Foley were lucky in many ways. They had good insurance. This book is one family's personal story that also reveals the pros and cons of our healthcare system. Amanda Bennett joins us here in our Philadelphia studio. She's the executive editor for Projects and Investigations for Bloomberg News. And Amanda Bennett, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Maria. Glad to be here.
Nice to have you here. Let me begin where your book begins. You met your husband in Beijing, China at a party. It was 1983. Set the stage for us.
And you know, it was so long ago that it wasn't really Beijing. It was Peking. It was that long ago. And I was a journalist. I was working for the Wall Street Journal. And I went to a party pretty late at night because I was tired. And I saw this guy dressed in a suit and a bow tie, which nobody dressed like that. And I was working on a very complicated story about Sino-Soviet relations, and it just turns out that this guy was an expert on Sino-Soviet relations. He knew everything about Russia and China, and he talked to me for a really long time. He was a Fulbright scholar, and he was there specifically to study Sino-Soviet relations. And then, you know, I lost track of him the next day.
Well, it turned out that he was not a Fulbright scholar, but he was head of the American Soybean Association. Was he lying to you?
He was lying through his teeth.
Was he trying to seduce you through his lies?
He was, in fact, trying to seduce me through his lies. And when I met him again several months later and realized the truth, I was pretty miffed, and my first official words are words that I couldn't say on a popular radio program.
But you felt that he had hoodwinked you, to say the least.
And he was quite open about it. He said, you know, you're a journalist. You were working on a story about China and Russia. How long would you have talked to me if I had told you I was in soybeans?
Well, is there some truth to that?
It was 100% true.
You would have moved on to somebody else.
I would have moved on to somebody else. And so he said he invented a character that would talk to me for as long as I was willing to talk to him.
But eventually you two got together.
We did. We got together. We got married. We had two kids. We traveled around the world. We moved from place to place. I followed my journalism career, and he reinvented himself career after career after career in order to follow me.
Well, and you include his bio. Bio isn't exactly the right word, because he seemed to have so many interests and things that he was pursuing through his life.
He spoke six languages. At the time of his death, he was learning to speak Arabic, which was his seventh language. He's played 15 musical instruments, including one of my previous jobs was editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer. And one Christmas, he serenaded the newsroom with tuba Christmas carols. And he was a San Francisco cable car operator. I was pretty sure he was also a spy, although I still to this day don't know that to be true. But, you know, he did a lot of stuff.
And you're sure he wasn't lying to you?
It is entirely possible that, you know, I address this in the book. I have no idea. It could have been a great lie. It could have been the truth. I have no way of knowing.
You describe, though, meeting him and I guess going to his apartment, and it sounded like he had hoarding tendencies. I mean, there were just mountains of things all over the place.
Oh, my God. And it's been 4 years since he died, and I'm still grappling with that. We have a storage area down on Delaware that's the size of a three-car garage that's still full of all his stuff. We have every musical instrument. We have things on birdhouses. We have things on medieval passion plays. We have boxes of papers. We have newspaper clippings that go back to the turn of the century. I mean, this guy was interested in everything.
And seemed to save everything.
He saved everything. He loved having his stuff.
Well, you do write about this marriage, this 20-year marriage, and you talk about the fact that you fought a lot with your husband.
We did. We had a really, you know, I think part of the issue was we were both very smart, and we were both very, very aggressive, and we were both right 100% of the time. And I think that was a part of the root of what we were dealing with. And, you know, that stayed the same pretty much for the entire part of our life.
Well, you describe him as being mysterious and maddening.
He was mysterious and maddening, but he was incredibly lovable. And this is part of the point of this book, is that we loved each other desperately. And that's what you do. This is a love story. This is a love story about people who fight to save the people they love. And that's why This isn't just a story about medical care. This is about human beings. And it's not just my story. It's everybody's story, because people who love people can't bear to see them go.
You needed him as well.
I needed him. I needed him, and I was willing to fight as hard as I could to keep him alive.
And you needed him because you loved him, or you were lonely without him?
Well, in China, I was lonely without him. But later on, I mean, this was a force of nature. Mm-hmm. I mean, he and I had a vibrant, passionate, intellectually stimulating, interesting life together. We also had two wonderful children that he believed to be the two best and most amazing children that had ever been born on the planet.
Of course.
Yeah. And so we had a lovely life together.
Well, and I don't want to focus on your fights, but you do have a description of where you went away for a couple of days and you came back and your husband had invited somebody over, a friend, and your children were there, and you came into the house and I think they were all in their underwear watching TV and the house was a mess and you just exploded.
You know, this is real life. We talk a lot about the love story of real life. So this is while all the cancer stuff is going on, but I go away from a trip and I come back and I walk in the house and all the recycling is scattered all over the kitchen. The dishes hadn't been done for 4 days. They were all piled up. There was pizza boxes. There were cans from spaghetti that they had opened up. He had draped the laundry all over the living room and over the lampshades to dry, and they had all had colds, and so they were throwing their tissues all over the floor, and the newspapers from Sunday was all there, and they were all sitting in their underwear watching TV, and I just lost it. And he took it for about 30 seconds, and then he turned around and said, but you told me you were coming home at night, not in the morning. So it was obviously my fault that I had come to find the house in this state, not his fault for letting it get that way.
Right, with the thought that he would have cleaned it all up and that all the evidence would have been hidden away.
That was the theory.
You also describe him getting sick, and he had these what sounded like excruciating pain.
Well, this is, you know, when we found the cancer, it wasn't like we were looking for it. He was quite ill with another illness. He had some intestinal trouble that really bothered him. We went to the emergency room for his intestines, and when they were scanning him to see what was wrong with his stomach, the doctor came back in and said, you know, Mr. Foley, you've got this shadow on your kidney, and, you know, we probably ought to take a look at it. And we were both really miffed at the guy. It was like, you know, I'm in pain. I've got some problems with my gut. I don't really want to hear about any stupid shadows. And if the doctors hadn't insisted, we would have just ignored it, because, you know, what's a shadow?
Indeed. But the pain was
something different.
It was colitis.
He had a bad case of colitis. So. Right. And that was sort of, we solved that problem, but it turned out that the shadow was kidney cancer, which is by far the more serious
and a rare form of kidney cancer, sounded like.
And that was one of the things about the book, and I think that everybody who goes through some of these things would like the chance to do what I did, which was to go back and look behind the scenes at what was going on, because we found it an enormously confusing and difficult thing, because sometimes they were saying it was one thing, sometimes they were saying it was another thing. So I was able to gather all the records and go back and see what the doctors were talking about behind the scenes, and to try and understand why it was that we were so confused. Was it our fault? Was it their fault? Was it nobody's fault? What was really going on?
Whose fault was it? I mean, to use a strong word there, but
I think it was the fault of the disease itself. And the fact is, you know, we put too much on the medical system to say 100% about what's going on. And, you know, I went back and I interviewed the surgeon, I interviewed all the oncologists, and I actually tracked down all the pathologists who had looked at the cancer. And amazingly enough, partly because my husband's personality was so strong and partly because he had a very rare cancer, everyone remembered him quite well. And so going back to see the pathologists who had looked at the cancer, you could see why it was that it was so confusing, because they didn't know themselves. So there were four pathologists, and of the four pathologists, there were really, you know, kind of two and a half opinions about what kind of a cancer it was. And each one of those cancers would have behaved slightly differently. So they sort of averaged it and told us something.
But that's what you learned in hindsight.
I learned of it in hindsight, and we didn't know it at the time. Mm-hmm. He was sick. They told us it was this incredibly rare, incredibly aggressive cancer. So we sort of braced ourselves for him to die in a couple of months, and then he didn't.
Mm.
And we couldn't figure out why. And it was only many years later, when he's still alive, and the other doctor says, well, no, you don't have this very aggressive cancer. You have this very slow-moving cancer. So, you know, we think of it as a very exact science, but I had the opportunity to actually, fascinatingly enough, look at the actual cancer cells that killed him, and I can see why it's complicated. I can see why it's a complicated thing. I didn't see that at the time. Somebody else saw it.
You describe, and I could totally relate to this, the watchful waiting. I mean, whether it's between diagnoses or between treatments or between interventions, there is, if you're a patient or the family or friends of a patient, that watchful waiting period where there's nothing particularly you can do.
And it was a very, very hard period for us because, you know, you call it watchful waiting, but basically watchful waiting means, hey, you know, we've run out of options. We don't,
exactly.
There's nothing else we can do. So let's just see what happens. And, you know, we were very active, aggressive people, and waiting wasn't something either of us did very well.
Well, in fact, you write, doing nothing is not something I do well. That's from your book.
Doing nothing is not something I do well.
So what did you do in this period? If you don't do this well, I mean,
you know, I think it's why this is a story of everybody, is we kept on trying to live, and we had an interesting, full, active life. We tried not to let the cancer take hold of us. We traveled. I moved to the job at the Inquirer. But at the same time, I think we did what a lot of people do, and that is we tried to find. We did research. I'm a journalist,
right.
And I was just face down in the internet. I was looking for doctors. I was looking for clinical trials. I kept signing him up for clinical trials, even though they said, you know, you're out of options. I kept finding all these different clinical trials, hoping to enroll him. I enrolled him in a bunch of them. He enrolled himself. Well, you know, actually, I'd like to make this point. This is a story about caregivers because mm-hmm. I think it's very, very common. I keep using the word I. I think it's very, very common that the loved one is the one that really winds up doing most of the work. He was terrified of his illness, and while he really, really wanted to stay alive, he was very happy to let me take the lead on this. And I think that's very common, that it's not the sick person, him or herself. It's the person that loves them that does the work.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. Amanda Bennett is our guest today on Radio Times. She's written a new book. It's a memoir. It's called The Cost of Hope, The Story of a Marriage, a Family, and the Quest for Life. She mentioned the Philadelphia Inquirer. She was editor of the Inquirer from 2003 to 2006, currently executive editor for projects and investigations for Bloomberg News. We're going to carry on our conversation after this short break. Open up the lines as well, 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. Its magical images have delighted generations. In a concert for families, Yannick Nezet-Séguin leads the Philadelphia Orchestra in scenes from Disney's Fantasia, accompanied by the iconic film and original animated scenes on a giant screen. Mickey Mouse and the Sorcerer's Apprentice, Waltzing Flowers, and more. It's all part of the Stokowski Celebration. Tickets online or 215-893-1999. Saturday, June 23rd at the Academy of Music, Disney's Fantasia in concert.
Hey, I'm Jed.
I'm Robert.
We make the show Radiolab,
which is mostly a show just for your ears.
But not anymore. Because coming soon to the Kimmel Center's Academy of Music...
A very different kind of Radiolab.
Yeah, eyeballs dancing.
Astronauts sizzling.
Holy cow.
Blind men yelling.
Sultan, you are trying to impose a visual totalitarianism upon the human brain.
Join us for Radiolab Live June 29th. Details are at radiolab.org/inthedark.
The rate of new HIV infection in Philadelphia is 5 times the national average. There are more than 30,000 living with the virus in our city, and 1 in 5 don't know it. June is AIDS Education Month, and Philadelphia Fight is holding events throughout June for youth, faith leaders, medical providers, and the greater community, including National HIV Testing Day on June 27th. All events are open to the public. More about AIDS Education Month at fight.org/AEM. Philadelphia Fight supports WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with Amanda Bennett about her new book, The Cost of Hope. It's about meeting her husband, Terrence Foley, in China, their 20-year marriage, raising two children, and their 7-year battle with cancer, which eventually took Foley's life. It's a very personal look at our expensive, redundant, and complicated healthcare system. Amanda Bennett is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, worked at the Philadelphia Inquirer, and now she is with Bloomberg News. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. As you said in the beginning, you were told this was a very aggressive cancer and that your husband might not live for, you know, for just a few months, and he ends up living for 7 years. Can you ever get away from the cancer when you're under those circumstances?
Well, and this is you know, you fight the cancer while you're doing everything else, and we chose to keep it very private. I don't think very many people knew that he had the cancer, but that enabled us to live a really full, active, and happy life. Mm-hmm. Even at the same time, we're going through this complicated and confusing and really, you know, really almost ununderstandable medical system that we're going through. So this is what happens to caregivers, is you try and keep your life going and you try and keep as much life in your life as you can, even while this very complicated thing is going on around you.
Did you keep things from your children? They were sort of young, I guess teenagers, or maybe even a little bit younger than that at the time.
You know, and that's part of that. In the book, I do say that this is not the story of our teenagers, because they were quite young during this time, and we were relatively honest with them. We told them Dad was sick, but we tried to let them live their life. Dad's sickness wasn't part of their life, so they knew that something was going on, but we kept it a little bit away from them. And I don't tell their story in this book, because they gave me permission to tell their dad's story, they gave me permission to tell my story, but they both said, you know, Mom, we're just not ready to tell ours yet. And so that seems like a very fair position on their part.
So you traveled, went out for dinner, I mean, did things that couples do, right?
We
families do.
We traveled, we went to Spain, we went to Australia, we traveled every place, we took new jobs. He was constantly pushing me to take new jobs and constantly, you know, being behind me. He changed jobs himself. He became a journalist himself at one point in order to follow me. So, and you know, we sat there, we did Little League, we did everything. We fought, you know.
We shouldn't be quite good at that.
It was one of our life skills. but it was a vibrant, right, interesting time, even despite the cancer. And I think that's one of the tricks is to try and fight it without letting it consume you.
Yeah. You write, what makes me think curing Terrence's cancer is my responsibility. You go on to say, I'm smart, I'm strong, I'm brave. I tell myself, if I try hard enough, I can save Terrence too. The idea that if you could just do enough research or talk to enough people, that you could figure out how to save your husband.
And I think I hear that from people over and over again, people that are involved in this with their mothers, their fathers, their own spouses, is the system is really so complicated that really you're the only person who knows the whole picture, and you feel like there's some discovery out there, there's some trial out there, there's some special doctor out there or some medicine out there, and it's my responsibility to find it. And that sort of becomes a compulsion.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and maybe a community as well, an online community.
Yeah, I became part of an online community, and you can feel everyone's just desperation to try and learn things from other people, right. And it's all very confusing.
How there were many doctors obviously involved in his care. When you would bring something that you had found on the internet to them, were they amenable?
You know, for a large part, they were very amenable and at least respectful of me. They listened to what I had to say, but on the other hand, this was you know, this was really an issue when you're trying to figure out who to pick the best doctor. Mm-hmm. It's very hard to understand if you're picking the best doctor or the best hospital. Each one of them has some particular drug or some particular procedure or some particular approach that they favor. And it sometimes takes a while to figure out you're not just picking a doctor. You're picking a drug. You're picking a trial. You're picking a way of doing things. And it mm-hmm. sometimes is kind of hard to tease that out.
You are a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. Did that have some cachet when you spoke?
It wasn't so much that it had cachet, is that, and it's one of the reasons I was able to do this book, is after Terrence died, I thought, I've got a skill set to do something that I think most people wish they could. I've got an investigative journalist skill set. I work at Bloomberg, and if there's one thing Bloomberg knows how to do, it's data. Mm-hmm. And I had an investigative editor, Chuck Babcock, who used to work at the Washington Post, and we found every single document relating to Terry's care. We found the every medical record, every insurance record, and we built spreadsheets to try and I tried to match my experience with what was going on behind the scenes, and to try and figure out, did I make the right choices? Was I making the choices the doctors wanted me to make? Were the doctors making the right choices? And then how much did it all cost?
Yes. Well, you found out it was $618,616.
That's right, and most of that was in the last year of the life. But mm-hmm. I also found out that, you know, even if I had wanted at the time to find out how much each of my choices was costing, I probably wouldn't have been able to do that, because it took us almost 6 months of work to try and figure mm-hmm. out, between the insurance company and the different kinds of bills and the discounting, how much things really cost. And even now, even after all this work, it's very hard to say how much things really did cost.
And we're talking about thousands and thousands of pages. I mean, this is a 7-year process, but nonetheless, thousands of pages of bills and documents.
Yeah, we unearthed in medical records and insurance records over 5,000 pages of documents. So if you think about a ream of copying paper as being 500, it was 10 of those. So like the size of a whole box of copying paper.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, with obviously dates, maybe a procedure, maybe a drug, maybe a hospital stay, all there documented.
Yeah, all of that documented. And then so there was all the medical records that were kept by the doctors and the nurses and all the various practitioners. But then there was also the insurance documents, which were the bills, and then what was actually paid, and then what we paid, and then what the insurance company paid. And, you know, for example, one of the interesting things we found out was there was really no rhyme or reason for these costs. Terrence had a whole series of scans, and one of the scans took place here in Philadelphia, right. And it was billed by the hospital at $3,500, and then it was paid by the insurance company at about $2,700. That was after the discount. And then the Enquirer got sold and my insurance plan changed. And so the only thing, so Terrence had another scan after that, and it was the same person, the same cancer, the same hospital. I'm pretty sure it was the same scanning machine, and it was the same $3,500 bill. And yet the new insurance company reimbursed only at $750. So the hospital got paid only $750. And then we accidentally saw the bill for someone, it got accidentally stuck in my pile of someone who's paying himself. He had no insurance, and he paid $1,600.
Wow.
So did the scan cost $3,500? Did it cost $2,300? Did it cost $750? Or did it cost $1,600? I have no idea. It all had to do with who's negotiating what. It had nothing to do with, was it a good scan? You know, was it a good hospital? Did we really need the scan? You know, nothing. It wasn't like buying a car.
And you had insurance, as you said, largely good insurance through this time, and probably better than most people that have insurance. And, of course, there are, 45 million people that don't have insurance whatsoever.
Well, and that's why this is an interesting story, is because this isn't the story of people who don't have insurance.
Exactly.
That's a great tragedy, and one that we hope that we'll be able to address sometime. But this is the story of the best of the medical system, not the worst. I had access to the best care. I had good insurance. I had the ability to get to the best doctors, the best hospitals, the best treatments, the most cutting-edge treatments. And still, it was complicated. I think there was over-treatment. The doctors themselves were absolutely fabulous and wonderful human beings who really genuinely wanted to help my husband, and yet the system that they worked in was complicated and opaque and very ununderstandable. So this is one of the things that I think is driving up the cost of medical care, is this redundancy and this opaqueness that you can't figure out what's going on.
I want to pick up on that. Let me just reintroduce you again, and Amanda Bennett, our guest today on Radio Times. She's written a new book called The Cost of Hope, The Story of a Marriage. It's about her 20-year marriage to a very interesting fellow. And he also, his name is Terrence Foley, about their 20-year marriage, raising their kids, but largely about their 7-year battle with his cancer, which eventually took his life. He died a couple of years ago, and she decided to take a look at the kind of care that he got. And the book is also about our medical system, a very personal story related to our medical system. Again, the subtitle, The Story of a Marriage, a Family, and the Quest for Life. And if there's something that resonates with you from this story, do give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. You looked at these medical records and you found that your husband had 76 CAT scans over a 7-year period. Wondering, I guess, why so many? Did he need all of those? Well, obviously.
Well, that's one of the interesting things. During the course of his illness, I had no idea how many CAT scans he had. And if you'd asked me after he died, I would have said, oh, I don't know, 12, 15 maybe. And it took us, you know, the whole 6 months to add everything all up to find out it was 76. And, you know, did every CAT scan ordered for good reason? Yeah, I think it was probably ordered for good reason. Was every CAT scan necessary? I don't think that's the case either. And if we had a little bit more transparency, perhaps, you know, we wouldn't have made entirely different decisions, but we might have been, you know, a little more careful.
You feel like, I mean, in hindsight, a lot of money was spent, but also spent on someone that lived for 7 years after having a diagnosis of cancer.
You know, that's the incredibly difficult thing, and one of the reasons I think people need help and need advocates is because, as I say, this book is a love story. It's about, love and a family and trying to keep going during this difficult time, and yet while I'm working, while I'm raising kids, while, you know, we're doing all this stuff, we're still trying to figure all this stuff out. And some of it had great effect, some of it had no effect at all. Some of it was useful, some of it was useless, and yet it was, for all the wonderfulness of our medical system and the great experts, we really felt it was all on us. And I think from talking to people around here who are engaged in the care of their parents and their spouses, most of them feel that way.
Well, and I have to say, as I was reading your book, I was thinking about my parents, both of whom died, and I was the executor. So since I was in the area, I was able to at least monitor some of their care and make decisions. And what I related to is that when you're in the thick of this stuff and you're in a medical crisis, it's hard to know what is the right thing to do. When do you say no? What is excessive? What does something cost? I mean, all those things you can't process it, nor do you have information about what was that the right thing to do?
It's very hard to process it. And as you say, most of the caregivers, I mean, you're doing this while you're doing other things in
exactly.
your life, and you want to keep your own life going, and you want to keep the life of the loved one you're trying to save happy. So it's very complicated, and it's very confusing, and you do feel like it's all pieces. There's this expert for that. There's, you know, with Terrence, it was, you know, there was this wonderful oncologist for his cancer, but there was another doctor for the tumor in his throat. There was another doctor for his stomach. There was another, you know, when he had some rashes from side effects, there was another doctor for that. And every single piece, the specialization is fabulous because it winds up with just wonderful care, but it's not organized around us and our life, and I wound up having to be the general contractor to all this, and you don't know, are you picking the right thing?
Well, and I remember even looking at my parents' living wills, and they both had them, and trying to say, okay, does this procedure fit this criteria? I mean, how do I reconcile what's being offered and what it is that this person said they do and don't want?
And we had a living will as well, and that was very hard to figure out as well too, because as you point out, it's hard to know when's the right time. And for Terrence, he really wanted to live.
Well, that's the other thing.
He wanted to live. We had two very young children. We had a lot to live for. And so, you know, he was pushing as hard as I could. I really wanted him to live.
Yeah. He did die, sadly, in December 2007.
Yeah, he did. He did. And and yet we did everything I could, and the fact is it's one of the things about the medical system is you know, I would have spent every single healthcare dollar in America to have saved him if I could. And yet he was a person who was very, very involved and very caring about what society needed. And I'm not sure in the end, if we had looked back, you know, he was learning to teach English as a second language, and he was helping one of the elementary schools in a very poor part of Philadelphia. And he was, you know, helping tutor kids and helping teach music to kids. And he really cared about the community. And so the difference mm-hmm. between, you know, what we needed and we wanted and was that the right thing, I think would have meant a lot to him.
Would have what a lot to him?
It would have meant a lot
meant
to him.
A
he
lot
would have,
to him.
He would right. have thought fact, he would have thought hard about that. So right. you know, I love this man. I wanna spend every dollar that anybody will possibly give me to save him, and yet afterwards we think, well, was that really the best thing to do? Yeah. Was that really the responsible yeah. thing to do? And even though it was his life, I think he would have thought hard about that.
Interesting. But what's also sometimes confounding with the system is that there are things that can be done. When people talk about, you know, well, let's take it back to the healthcare system we had. What about in the 1950s and 40s? There wasn't a lot that could be done, and now you can intervene.
Well, and that's again, it's one of the confounding, wonderful, and difficult things is we believe we eked out extra months of life for him. We were part of a clinical trial of an experimental drug that has since been approved, that is now extending the life for, you know, many, many people. And that's why, you know, on the other side of the equation, mm-hmm. when people say, well, why do you want to spend $30,000 to get 5 or 6 more weeks of life? Well, you know, we weren't thinking of weeks. We were thinking of months and years. And, you know, his participation in a clinical trial, this experimental drug, did help get this drug approved. And now other people are living considerably longer with this same disease, you know, partly as a result, I like to think, of the work that he did in being part of the test of it.
You write about, and I think we all remember the whole false death panel controversy, but the idea that, you know, somehow the government was going to pull the plug on a loved one. And I know that was in part an impetus for writing this book. I mean, there needs to be coordinated care, but the idea of calling these death panels is so offensive.
Well, that was in fact one of the things that made me start to think about this. I heard the term death panel and I thought, well, that's a pretty ugly word. And you know, I would have really liked to have some independent coordinated voice to help me sort through all the different conflicting things. And then later on I started to think that the idea that this is going to somehow cause, you know, somebody to pull the plug on your loved one, well, you know, there are arbitrary decisions being made every day right now based on all kinds of criteria. It's not like that's going to change. It's just perhaps we might be able to make them more rationally and more compassionately than they're being made right now. Right now it's, you know, if you have good insurance, you get the money. If you don't have good insurance, you don't. That's pretty simple.
Let's take another short break. We have some callers that want to join us as well at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Talking with Amanda Bennett. She's executive editor for projects and investigations for Bloomberg News. She worked at the Philadelphia Inquirer for a couple of years as an editor. She's a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist, and her new book is called The Cost of Hope, The Story of a Marriage, a Family, and the Quest for Life. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
The Wilmington University College of Business supports WHYY and offers undergraduate business management programs focusing on organization, human resources, and sports management. Students learn to analyze contemporary business challenges and create innovative solutions under the direction of faculty with real-world experience. Courses begin every 8 weeks and may be completed 100% online. For more information about Wilmington University's business programs, wilmu.edu/onlinebusiness. I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. We'll take a look at 8 cities expecting big job growth. They include Phoenix, Raleigh, Nashville, and Orlando. Also, the HBO series Girls wraps up its first season. Love it or hate it, and I love it. The show takes an unflinching look at some 20-somethings. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
The Wistar Institute supports WHYY-FM. I'm Dr. Russell Kaufman, president of the Wistar Institute. The newest cancer treatments almost always start with a breakthrough in basic science research. Wistar researchers identify the causes of cancer, and this can lead to treatments that directly target the causes without the harmful side effects of older cancer therapies. Basic research saves lives and needs your support. To learn more about how you can join us and help save lives, visit wistar.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowain talking with Amanda Bennett about her new book, The Cost of Hope, The Story of a Marriage, a Family, and the Quest for Life. And we have just one open line at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Tim from Hillsborough, New Jersey to join our conversation. And Tim, go ahead.
Good morning.
Good morning. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. It's interesting that she was talking about the possibility of asking or passing over a test. I have done that. I've actually turned down a CAT scan when it was requested by the doctor because I thought it was too invasive and it would have been just too hard to perform. But I asked that question because what would have happened when she went into the doctor with her husband in the beginning when he had colitis, mm-hmm. and it turned out he had colitis, but, oh, by the way, you have a shadow on your kidney. We need to look at that, you know. So it's kind of like a double-edged sword. Should you or shouldn't you?
Say no, and essentially saying no to a doctor or to a procedure. Go ahead.
And that's absolutely right, because, you know, to say that you just always say no is ridiculous, because, in fact, a lot of the times it's very useful. And the only thing I found was that not being a medical expert, it was very hard for me to figure out whose advice to take.
Yeah, which gets to that doctor, that relationship with not just doctors, but nurses and other medical people.
And the fact that it wasn't coordinated, there were so many different voices kind of speaking at me.
Indeed. Tim, thanks for the call. Let's see what Beverly from Wilmington has to say. Beverly, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
Good morning.
Good morning.
This is a very interesting show to me because I had kidney cancer when I was 32.
Oh, wow.
That was 35 years ago.
Wow.
I survived.
What you must have
as a patient, a strong advocate, and good insurance makes a big difference.
Indeed.
My husband made himself an expert in this, and because mine was discovered serendipitously, like your husband's, but you can't emphasize too much. You need a strong advocate, and good insurance really helps because you have everything at your disposal.
Indeed. Well, Beverly, I'm glad you survived.
Yeah.
I'm glad you called as well.
Yeah, thank
your
you
thoughts,
so much,
Amanda.
Good for you, absolutely. And the strong advocate is really part of the issue. And it's the part about being a strong advocate for yourself and trying to figure out as much as you can is really a lot of what this book is about.
Yeah. And was that something you had to learn? I mean, it sounds like you're the kind of person who would advocate under many different circumstances. I mean, it seems like that's part of your personality, to take charge.
Advocating wasn't the hard part for me. It was actually finding out what was true and what was real, because there was so much research out there, and different doctors had different points of view, and they had different understandings of things, and they all had different trials that they were sort of wanted to try out themselves. So just trying to sort through all of that was what I found the hardest.
I mean, you talk about a coordinator. I mean, someone that would help, that could have helped you, or perhaps could help others navigate through the system. Do you think that would be helpful?
Yeah, you know, one of the things I discovered is that in a serious illness, there's no true bystanders. Nobody's a bystander. So even the best doctor, the doctor wants to believe he can help and he or she can cure you, and the hospitals want to help and they want to make money, and the drug companies want their drugs to succeed. And Terrence and I weren't bystanders either.
Yeah.
We wanted to get him well. So
yeah.
Having somebody sort of outside that to sort of be a referee for all of it, I think would have been very helpful.
Yeah. And not to belabor this, but he did die in December 2007. Did you feel like there was something else you could have done? Did his death sort of make sense at that time?
Well, you know, it was clear by the end that we shouldn't do anything more. But it's one of the downsides when I talk about the cost of this hope. One of the costs is an emotional cost. Mm-hmm. I kept right on pushing till, you know, a good week before his death. There was another pill I wanted to try. And so as a result of that, you know, we didn't really ever get to say goodbye.
Oh, really? Yeah. Well, you were over. There's a phone call that you had with him where his voice is kind of raspy and.
I was in China again. Yeah. I had gone back to China with our daughter, and I called from China, and he's coughing, and I'm thinking, oh well, you know, you should get some NyQuil. And it didn't occur to me at the time that was the cancer coming back.
But you thought, gosh, we could try this one more pill, one more treatment, one more thing.
Let's try one more thing.
Well, again, quoting from your book, looking back, I asked myself over and over again how much of what I did for Terrence wasn't really for Terrence at all, but for me.
Well, and that's something I think that caregivers all have to ask themselves, because I don't think, and that was part of what drove me through the research, is to go back to the people that dealt with him and to find out, and to go back to his friends and to find out, was he really with me all the time and was I in denial? Mm-hmm. And I think, by and large, he was, with a little bit different towards the end. But yeah, I mean, I was on fire with the desire to save him. And I think it's very easy to get yourself pushing to keep someone alive who may not be as enthusiastic about it as you are.
And I would think denial can be very effective under these stressful, adverse circumstances.
I think denial is a very ugly word, because I practiced denial, and I think it was an extremely effective coping mechanism. Yeah, I was the queen of denial.
Let me see what Sue from Turnersville has to say. And Sue, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi
there.
I'm enjoying your conversation, but I work for a leading cancer center, an academic institution in Philadelphia. We're previously in a pediatric one. But I just wanted to talk to you about the coordination of care and what there's a trend in the population of, they're called patient navigators. Mm-hmm. And it's usually a nurse or a social worker who navigates the patient care. And it's specific to that disease site, especially when it comes to academic institutions. So if it's a GI or a breast or, a GU is what we call types of cancers, you should ask your cancer center if there's a patient navigator who can help you navigate through what we call the multidisciplinary approach, which is the surgeon, the radiation oncologist, the medical oncologist, the medicine, physicians, the interventional medicine that's also involved. And they are really a vital role in the cancer care moving into the future. Then there's also, outside of that, there's also these private firms that are patient advocates, and they're usually nurses as well, who will go on patient appointments. So they'll coordinate your appointments and things like that, and they'll also assist you in your appointments. And it's usually not related with the hospital that you're that you're visiting, but they're outside. It's an outside firm, and so they help you navigate questions, like certain questions that you should be asking.
Sure. Well, Sue, I appreciate the call to Radio Times, and it's good to know that there are those services and those individuals that can help people navigate the system.
I think that's absolutely right, and I think that's part of the, as you say, the trend of the future. I don't think it's widely available just yet, but I think it's really wonderful. Although I would hope at some point the system itself kind of starts to streamline, so you don't need a paid navigator to go through it. But I absolutely agree with you that's what I was sort of hoping to find.
Yeah, Sue, thanks for calling into Radio Times. You can call as well, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. So do you understand why our healthcare system gobbles up so much of our economy?
Well, it's really clear. I mean, the very fact that 7 years of treatment creates 5,000 pages of documents that each treatment creates a bill from the hospital, a bill for this service, a bill for the person who takes the scan, a bill for the person who reads the scan. You know, almost a third of our healthcare dollars are spent on paperwork.
Yeah,
I mean, that's pretty That's pretty high. So you can really understand why it is, and then the fact that there is this sort of tendency towards doing more than is absolutely necessary, and then the tendency towards redundancy and confusion. Mm-hmm. I think you can really see that there's lots of opportunities, short of denying care to people, to make the system a lot more effective and also better for the people that are in it.
Yeah. Let me get, looks like Anthony from York, Pennsylvania, to join our conversation. Anthony, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
You're on the air.
I really enjoy the program,
Thank you.
I noticed that your book, you've written from the point of view of the caregiver. And I'm a caregiver of a spouse who's fighting mental illness. Mm. And my question to you is, what advice do you give caregivers on how to take care of the caregiver so they have something to give? What did you do, like, the last 2 years of your husband's life that helped you through it?
Great question. Thanks for calling, Anthony. Go ahead, Amanda.
You know, that's exactly right. I was a caregiver, and I was also a mother of two young children, and I had a job, and so at some point it was really kind of flat out, and I'm not sure that's the best thing. And I bet that when you're a caregiver of a spouse with mental illness, I bet that there's times when you feel like you're flat out. And I think there was a point where I said, you know, I'm the machine that is holding this entire thing together, and it's not selfish, it's not self-indulgent for me to take care of that machine, because if I break, everything breaks.
Yeah.
And so I had to change the focus around to really paying attention to myself and my own mental health.
Well, what did you do for yourself?
Well, I tried not to worry so much, I think, is part of it. I tried to focus on the good stuff that was going on in my life, and to be happy about the things that we had. I think that was really important for me, and I know it's very, very easy to say, but to live, one of the things I learned halfway through his illness was to live in what we had and not worry about losing it. And I think that was incredibly useful for me. You know, I don't know if that applies to your situation, but I do think the issue of taking care of yourself first probably applies to every caregiver.
Indeed. Anthony, thanks for calling into Radio Times. Did you have friends you could talk with, people that knew what that was going on, that you could
It was a choice we made to keep it very private, and that's not the choice I think everyone would make, but actually I think it was a very effective choice for us, because we actually didn't want to have every day begin with, oh, how are you? Oh, how are you doing? We didn't want that to happen. And so I think each person has to make the choice that's right for them. Some people take a lot of sustenance from their friendships and the people, you know, expressing concern. And we, on the other hand, just wanted to live our lives. Mm-hmm. And I think that was actually a pretty effective choice for us.
Were your friends, though, shocked that sort of learning what you had been going through?
I think a lot of people, you know, were surprised, because, you know, they had known perhaps that he had had something wrong with him, but they didn't realize quite how ill he was.
Indeed. Let me see what looks like Kathy from Voorhees has to say. And Kathy, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. I hadn't read your book, but I would love to read your book. I'm a hospice nurse of 25 years, and I've used it for my family, also gone through cancer with my husband. And I just think that can be an incredible support, and someone that can kind of guide you through that. And there's palliative care docs that kind of guide you through that, instead of end of life running here and there to get painful tests or time-consuming tests, to use a palliative care doc or to use hospice. And the other thing I wanted to comment on is I think denial is a fabulous tool. I think once you have your ducks in a row and everything is organized, why not live each day just to the fullest and not think about what the end game is going to be? So I think you're absolutely right with that.
Well, thank you. I think that was actually our choice. And as I say, it may not have been everybody's choice, but I think it was a pretty effective one for us. It came with a price, but I think, you know, for me, it was a pretty good price. And I completely agree. Terrence did die in hospice. We did choose hospice towards the very end. Had we known a little bit more, would we have chosen it earlier? I don't know the answer to that question, but I do know from my research that people do tend to choose hospice a little too late.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because I'm looking at the computer screen, Kathy. the hospice nurse we were just talking to, and it says here they don't call soon enough.
They don't call soon enough, yeah. And I think that's something we found in our experience, and again with my research, I think that's what people are finding.
Yeah. Was this a hard book to write?
No, it was a wonderful book to write. It was a wonderful book to write because I had a skill set that let me do what I think a lot of people want to do, which is find out to the best of my ability, did we do the right thing, and to find out what was going on around us. And also, because he was such an unusual, strange, interesting, wonderful guy, I found the writing of the book let me spend an extra year with him.
Oh, I was going to ask you about that, whether the act of writing allowed you to sort of relive some of your life.
Absolutely. Somebody said, you know, you can spend a whole year going through your pictures and going through your videos and going through all your memories and your books and the containers full of stuff that he kept, and you get to write about it. I think he'd get a big kick out of the fact that hopefully his story is helpful to other people.
You have a long, I can't find it here, but just a long list of what things, his things. It's an amazing list of stuff that he had.
Oh, well, that was about 3 years after his death. I couldn't bear to take his dresser apart, and it was about 3 years after his death I finally was able to do it, and I cataloged everything I took out, and he had model battleships, and he had juggling things, and he had books in Japanese, he had books in French, he had books in Chinese, he had a thing on how to learn ventriloquism, he had a thing on North Korea, he had something on imperialism, you know, in his dresser drawer I found about 6 musical instruments tucked away, including a set of bagpipes.
Mm-hmm. This was a dresser drawer.
It was a dresser drawer. There was no clothes in the dresser drawer. I have no idea where he kept his clothes.
Well, on that note, Amanda Bennett, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you so much, Marty.
You're very welcome. And the book is called The Cost of Hope, The Story of a Marriage, a Family, and the Quest for Life. It's published by Random House. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out more about this program. Bob Ball's the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for those phone calls as well.